Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Can You Just Sit With Me? Healthy Grieving for the Losses of Life by Natasha Smith. Narrated by Natasha Smith. Dedication to my loving husband, Clinton, for your unwavering presence and support throughout the years, for sitting with me, praying with me, and being there for me during such deep grief, even when you didn't know what to do or what to say. Your willingness to learn how to just sit with me has meant the world to me. Your love and care have been invaluable, and I am endlessly grateful for everything you do for me. I love you so very much. To my beloved children, Emma, Trey, Christian, and Isabella, your support and encouragement allow me the space to write this book. Your presence and enthusiasm have meant the world to me, and I am deeply grateful for every cheer, hug, and celebration we've shared together. You are the best, and I am beyond proud to be your mom. I love you so much. And in loving memory of my dad, Linwood, and my sisters, Angie and Sharon. Can you just sit with me? I know you cannot fully understand what you have never experienced. But can you just sit here with me, even if you can't find the words to say? Can you just sit here with me, though it may make you a little uncomfortable? Can you just sit with me in the hurting, in the pain, in the grief? Can you just sit with me in the questioning, in the confusion? Can you just sit with me when I'm reaching long and high and wide for an ounce of empathy? Can you just sit with me? Can you just sit with me? Not to insert an opinion. Can you just sit with me to listen, to learn, to show you care? Can you just sit with me? Introduction. Someday you're going to look back on this moment of your life as such a sweet time of grieving. You'll see that you were mourning and your heart was broken, but your life was changing. Elizabeth Gilbert. Waiting rooms. I remember sitting in the waiting room with my mom as we waited for Dad to get a biopsy. The room seemed particularly full on that day, with groups of families seated together, some chatting, some quiet, some staring off into space. I'd run into an old classmate in the parking lot after I dropped Mom and Dad off at the door. "Hey, Tasha," she spoke. "Oh, hey. It's so good to see you. How are you?" "I'm good. So good to see you." "You too. Do you live in the area?" "Yes, I work here. What about you?" "Oh, I'm here with my dad. He has an appointment here today." It was just small talk, a shallow conversation in passing with an old friend. Shallow because we usually keep the full story to ourselves, at least until we have identified a safe place to let it all out. At least until we have identified a person who is willing to sit with us to discuss more of the details, the real and raw of our stories. For my family, the results of this day would affect us deeply. As I continued to walk toward the building, I noticed people without expression entering and exiting the building. I guess it was a place where joy was somewhat fleeting. Dad's procedure wasn't scheduled to take long. I felt as if much hung in the balance, depending on the doctor's report. I'd already resolved in my heart, no matter what the doctors say, I will believe the report of the Lord. But that didn't diminish my desire for the doctor's report to align with heaven, that by the stripes of Jesus, Dad was healed and whole. I hoped Dad would get a clean bill of health from the doctors. As we sat in the waiting room, I grabbed a cup of coffee from the small concession counter set up in the back of the room, grabbed a magazine from the table beside me, and began to occupy my mind as we waited for Dad's procedure to be completed. For a moment, I lifted my eyes from reading to see a man consoling a woman who was crying. I couldn't take my eyes off her. I wanted to look away, but couldn't. I didn't know what had happened to her and her family, but my heart hurt for her. Then something on the inside of me, I know now the Holy Spirit, nudged me to ask if I could pray for her. My heart thumped harder and harder like a stampede of elephants. I looked around the room to see if anyone was watching me, because I was sure the entire room could hear my heart beating. And like most times when the Holy Spirit nudges me to pray for someone, I questioned it. Really? Do you really want me to do that? So I finally told my mom I'd be right back, peeled myself from the seat, and headed over to this lady. I knelt beside her chair and looked her in the face and asked, "Do you mind if I pray for you?" Tears streamed down her face, and she placed her hand on mine, nodded, and said, "Yes, please." My husband just went in for emergency triple bypass surgery. Thank you so much. So I prayed. I don't quite remember what I prayed, and I don't know what the outcome was, but I do believe God comforted her at that moment. Maybe it comforted her that even a stranger would choose to sit with her in this hard time. This would happen several times more at appointments with Dad, like on the cancer patient floor in Dad's last days. I just walked in to grab a cup of coffee in the family waiting room, and a wife whose husband was losing his battle with cancer sat alone in the middle of a cushioned sofa. She had both hands to her face, crying. I leaned toward her and asked, "Are you okay?" "My husband, he's not going to make it." "Oh no, I'm sorry. So sorry," I said, holding back my own emotion. "Do you mind if I pray with you?" She nodded her head yes. Then I prayed with her and hugged her before leaving. I don't know the outcome, but I do believe God met her that day. I believe God sat with her during her time of grief, and he sits with us, whether physically through another loved one, a trusted friend, and sometimes even a stranger. God is always there, ever present. We are never alone. The wind blows across our faces when we step outside for a walk. Oh, that's God. The salty air of the beach and sand between your toes. That's God too. Jesus sits with us even now, even as he sits at the right hand of the Father praying for us. It encourages me even today how God can use us and others to be his hands and feet here on the earth, to comfort those who need to physically feel his comfort. And even when we feel alone, maybe in the darkest of times in this journey of grief, we are never alone. First, we always have God with us. And second, God will send someone our way to sit with us if it is our desire. Maybe you're sitting listening to this in a waiting room. Maybe it's not a literal waiting room, but you are sitting in the in-between, between life after loss and what to do now or next. Maybe you've thought of the many times you've just felt alone. I've felt alone for most of my grief journey. I don't say this to speak against those who love me or those around me. It is simply the truth. Maybe you're struggling with how to help someone who is in a time of grief. My husband will even admit to not knowing how to support me through my bouts of grief, but he truly has grown and learned how over the years. And that in itself is to be commended. When we love those who are hurting, those who grieve, we take action to learn how we can best help and be a support to them. I'm reminded of an old hymn, "Never Alone." The song reminds us how Jesus is always with us, how he promised never to leave us alone. So even when I felt alone, and even when you feel alone, we are never alone. These days, I find myself more in a supportive community with connect groups at church, writing communities, and prayer groups. I often think, oh, how I wish I had this during the throes of deep grief. I even had a moment of grief over not having the support that I am now a part of, because it is just that beautiful, someone to just sit with me, not to ask me invasive questions about the death, not to try and fix me, not to give me advice, but to listen, to sit with me just for a little while in the ashes, knowing full well, as I know, that I'm not going to stay there, but knowing that I need to sit here for a moment to grieve, to catch my breath, to breathe, and to acknowledge this loss. I needed that, and I want that for you. So as you listen to this book, can I just sit with you? Chapter 1. Say That Again. Perhaps grief is a true reflection of hell, where the ache of losing God and all good, including the good of community, will be endless. Be that as it may, a most painful part of the pain of grief is the sense that no one, however sympathetic and supportive in intention, can share what we are feeling. And it would be a betrayal of our love for the lost one to pretend otherwise. So we grieve alone, and the agony is unbelievable. J.I. Packer. On November 22, 1998, I flailed around my dorm room, unable to keep my footing as waves of confusion, shock, and anger crashed against the ship of my mind. Disbelief submerged me as I exhaled, unable to catch my breath. Angie died this morning. Those words rang out like a piercing megaphone in my ear, and in a shaky voice I murmured, "Wait, what happened now?" Angie died this morning. I dropped the phone to the floor, tears racing down my face. Dazed and confused, my tears turned to sobs, and sobs turned to wails. Unable to hear my thoughts, it felt as if my brain shut down. After a moment, my vision cleared. My eyes burned as I stared into space. This can't be true. She's only 32. I prayed for God to heal her, and He promised, I stammered. I had plans. We had plans. I hoped to see my sister a few days before Thanksgiving break, but it was too late. This is grief. In 2004, when I started my career, I dreamed of climbing the corporate ladder. As a first-generation university graduate, I felt my future was as bright and certain as the rising sun. I wanted to shatter every glass ceiling placed on every African-American woman. But in 2015, I chose to leave my career as an engineer in the pharmaceutical industry to homeschool our children. I remember bouts of sadness during the first 5 years. Each day away from the office felt like walking in slow motion through quicksand. Homeschooling challenged me to the core, mentally and spiritually. I battled the call to homeschool alongside my desire to climb the corporate ladder. I traded suits and heels for jeans, joggers, and leggings. Nearly every day, I felt like a failure in less than. Crying often, depression took over my heart as daily I felt like someone else. The me I knew myself to be disappeared. My identity shifted, and it grieved me. This identity crisis. This is grief. I remember my 7-month prenatal visit and routine checkup in the fall of 2001. At 7 months, a baby measures about 14 inches long and weighs between 2 and 4 pounds. The baby's hearing is fully developed. The baby changes position frequently and responds to stimuli, including sound, pain, and light. The checkup started with a routine blood pressure check and my weight. Shirt lifted, pants tugged at the waist, cold jelly applied. The technician positioned herself to check the baby's heartbeat. Seconds ticked by. A minute passed. She squirted additional jelly, then repositioned the heartbeat monitor, but nothing came from the speakers. Deathly quiet. Concern etched itself on the nurse's face. "I'll be right back," she said. I swallowed and told myself not to cry. "What is wrong?" She re-entered the room. "The doctor ordered you to the ER for an internal ultrasound," she said. "Sometimes baby likes to hide, so we want to get a better look." I felt nauseous over her sense of false hope, but I still prayed and believed. Maybe the equipment was misread or malfunctioned, right? Once in the ER, I submitted to the internal exam, trying to tamp down my fears. It felt like an eternity after the internal exam and the ultrasound. Though I prayed, dread led in me. The doctor entered the room, concern on his face. "I'm so sorry to have to say this to you, but your baby is dead." It felt as if my spirit left my body, and I looked at what unfolded like a TV drama. Thoughts, images, and words flashed and raced in my mind. How did this happen? What changed so drastically from last month? Is this really happening? The doctor interrupted my thoughts. "Because you are so far along, we will need to induce and deliver the baby." Like salt on a fresh wound, his words stung. A glimmer of light shone from a lamp in the corner of the delivery room, while each labor pain sent wave upon wave of grief. The nurses suggested heavy medication to ease the pain. "There's no need for you going through unnecessary pain at this point," one said. I agreed. My body was numbed from the physical pain, while my mind reeled over the hope I held in my heart. Maybe God would perform a miracle before the baby was expelled from my body. I knew He could. After hours of hopeless labor, I delivered a dead baby. The room was dark, still, silent, and cold. The nurse carefully handed him to me. I embraced his little body in my arms and stared at him. 10 fingers, 10 toes, tears drenched my face. After a while, the nurse took away the baby. For days, I spoke only in tears. Staying on the maternity floor of the hospital, baby sounds surrounded me. Once home from the hospital, my body played a terrible trick on me as my milk came in, reminding me of the baby I didn't get to bring home. And the death of this baby reminded me of multiple miscarriages before this death. This is grief. In 2020, we face a global pandemic shutdown, confined to our homes. The news assaulted me continuously. I scrolled Facebook and read about the death of Ahmaud Arbery in February, the death of Breonna Taylor in March, and the death of George Floyd in May. These events shook the low-hanging fruit of deeply held hurts in the African-American community. Everything that could be shaken felt shaken by police violence. Instead of empathy and compassion for the loss of 3 lives, people met my hurt and pain with voices of defense, deflection, and cliches like, "just get over it," or "keep the past in the past." Friends and media entities labeled victims as hostiles. Riots, politics, racial divide, the climate, and culture felt like a pressure cooker that could explode at any moment. My heart felt dark, heavy, with a thick tension. Vile, unspeakable language spewed from great and small, even from respected leaders in the church. Some showed a shadow of love from one side of their lips and vile, uncaring words from the other side. Their words did not mix. We all get the same start in life. "You got Obama for president. You should be happy." Those people. Vote the right way. "I have black friends. I'm not racist." I heard many loud voices shouting opinions, but internally I asked, "Can you just listen? Can you just sit with me?" Sadly, I learned during that dark time that sticks and stones still break bones, but words hurt even more. Hope felt stripped within the walls of many churches. What we heard on the news, we also heard within the 4 walls of the church. We needed hope, yet we felt hopeless. Conversations void of Jesus fell on itching ears to proclaim the news of the best presidential candidate rather than the good news of Jesus Christ. My heart felt as if it could burst. It felt like death, but no one we knew died. The atmosphere charged forward with hate and heaviness, like water poured into a paper towel, bound to break at some point. We learned that when someone said all lives matter, all did not include the lives of people of color. I sensed some of my white counterparts cared for me and my family as people, but if pressed, they might say something like, "You're one of the good ones, so we like you." I wondered, if they saw my nephew on the street, how would they view or treat him? Along with my grief, I felt the added pressure to get over it quickly. Folks would say things like, "It's just how it is. Get over it," or "It's time to move on." unspoken, deep-seated ideology surfaced instead of life-giving words. Fear and doubt promoted trust in man above God. In any words spoken about the pain and hurt of people of color were taken as antichrist or demonic. I thought, I don't know this Jesus who is unconcerned with all people groups. The atmosphere in our country felt chaotic and confusing. I had to keep reminding myself that God is not the author of confusion. My friend Stevie Swift says, there are no throwaway people. But it felt as if those whose lives were intentionally taken were disposable trash, waiting to be thrown away with the next day's garbage, not even worthy of being recognized as the human beings they were. Hope for change, for racial reconciliation, for justice, for unity in the church and America felt hopeless. This is grief. In August 2011, my sister Sharon called just a few short days after I visited her at home, after her emergency surgery to remove part of an intestine due to a blockage. Happy to hear her voice, the joy in my spirit turned to angst. My stomach knotted up and my muscles tensed as she spoke. The doctor diagnosed me with cancer, she said. I felt thrown into a dark tunnel. Her voice was muffled, and I stopped breathing for what seemed the remainder of the conversation. I tried to remain calm and controlled. I stuffed my emotions down, as I had learned to do over the years, while she described what the doctor called a promising outlook. Weeks later, my niece Nicole called frantically. They're asking what to do, she said. What to do about what? I answered. Mom is unresponsive, and they're asking me what to do. Her voice registered panic. My heart did too. I told myself to be calm. Tell them to do whatever they need to do to keep her alive, I told her. For weeks, we prayed, fasted, and lived at the hospital. After work, my niece and I alternated evenings at her bedside. I read healing scriptures over her, and the slightest signs of improvement nudged on our faith. The physical and occupational therapists were scheduled to begin. But then I received the call. The doctor says she's brain dead, and the medical team needs the family to decide about life support, my niece said through tears. The hospital support staff encouraged us to say our last words to Sharon. No, she can't hear me anyway, I told the staff. To be honest, I didn't know what I was saying. I wanted to tell her everything, but forming words was hard. I said goodbye, but my heart reeled. Who dies only 2 months after a cancer diagnosis? Sharon was 42 when she took her last breath on this earth. This is grief. In the summer of 1996, I isolated myself from the world. For months, I juked and dodged almost everyone I knew to hide an unplanned teen pregnancy. One summer night, I sat afraid in a warm, water-filled tub, unaware of the moments to follow. My back felt as if a 300-pound weight lay on it while a sensation of a tight squeeze and release played out in my abdomen. I shifted from side to side to ease the pain. At 40 weeks, labor commenced. My sister drove me to the hospital where I delivered a healthy, stunning baby. I held him in my arms and melted. I wanted to keep him, but I gave him away already, I cried. The adoption agency liaison took my baby boy to his new parents that day. Now somewhere out there, there is a boy who made me a mama for the first time. I've only seen him in photos since the day I birthed him. Does he even know I exist? I pray over him every day when I pray for my kids who are with me. I wish we were a part of each other's lives. This is grief. In the fall of 2012, my dad arrived at the ER with high blood pressure and abnormal blood sugar levels. He smiled as I walked into the room just before the doctor asked me to step into the hallway. "I believe your dad has lymphoma. His scans show enlarged lymph nodes, and I'd like to refer him to a doctor at the cancer center." My heart crashed, yet something rose inside me. "No, this is not happening again," I told the doctor. But he believed it to be the same type of cancer that caused my sister Sharon's death. Determined to disrupt and change the narrative, we prayed, believed, and grasped for Dad's healing, like a miracle within reach. Test after test, scan after scan, for over a year, the doctor gave Dad a clean bill of health. Dad beat cancer that time, but it resurfaced in the spring of 2016. His lack of appetite and the sudden loss of his sight indicated a truth my heart denied. There were no answers from the primary physician, so I arranged for care with the oncologist Dad had visited 5 years prior. Within 6 months, my family and I arrived at a hospice facility behind the medical transport carrying my dad. At the time, I was unfamiliar with hospice care, but would come to know it well. I clearly remember one of my children saying, "Mommy, this place is nice." The facility boasted comfy chairs, snacks, lots of sunlit rooms, flowers, and inviting decor. Empathetic cooks prepared nourishing food as if they knew our grief-stricken hearts needed it. I told my niece Nicole, "Dad's going out in style." The family designated me to complete the paperwork that named who to call to notify of Dad's passing and what funeral home to send his body to. The task overwhelmed me. When I turned in the paperwork, the nurse said, "Your dad is in the active stage." "What does that mean?" I asked. "He's in the active stage of dying, so it shouldn't be much longer now," she told me. My family and I sat, talked, and kept Dad's mouth moistened by placing a small, wetted sponge on his lips. His eyes opened, but he did not respond. The daylight from the window turned to darkness. Now, in a dimly lit room, my family and I watched Dad's chest rise and fall. Shallow breaths came and went at longer and longer intervals. With each breath, we wondered if it would be his last. We sat. I waited for hours. I kissed my dad and whispered, "Good night, Daddy. I love you." I left. The nurse called me in the middle of the night. "Your dad transitioned peacefully," she said. This is grief. In May 2019, I received a call from my niece, Nicole. "Anthony's been shot." "Is he all right?" I asked, swallowing my fear. "I don't know. They've taken him to the hospital," she said. "I'm on my way. I'll meet you there." I rushed over an hour away to meet her at the ER. The details were still unknown, and I had that too familiar feeling of my heart sinking, then racing. I talked with Jesus with every single breath as I drove. When I arrived, family members stood in the hallway outside of the operating room. Shortly after that, the medical team came into the family waiting room. "We did everything we could do," the doctor said. It felt like a scene from The Matrix. Everything moving in slow motion. Furniture flew across the room, while some of my relatives fell to the floor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?